Hey guys, let's face it, you're probably listening to this show and all of your other shows on your phone. Are you tired of filling up your phone with all your favorite podcasts? Well, you stream your movies, you stream your music, you stream your porn, why not stream your podcast? Try Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is an app that allows you to stream over 30,000 shows right to your smartphone or pad. Get the best in news, comedy, entertainment, science, sports, and anything you want, really. Download it for free at Stitcher.com or find it in your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host, Johnny Maldi.
All right, hello. I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to episode 499, part two, The Conversations. In this episode, this will be a clip show of conversations that I had with people. I just went around, snipped some little parts off that I liked and stories that I thought were cool. And so here you get a little, the highlights of my conversations over the last 100 episodes. I want to thank all of you guys for listening. This has been a great trip. I love doing it. Look for episode 500 with AJ Vallejo, Nakia, Taylor Muse, Susanna Schofel, and the great Kathy Valentine, live from the Townsend. That will be out on Friday, episode 500. All right, well, let's dig into this clip show, which is going to be a lot of fun. We'll go right back to episode 414 from back in September 2015, when I sat down and had a great conversation with Joe King Carrasco. And in this clip, he tells me about getting banned from Saturday Night Live and why it happened. Oh, no. I lived in Austin then. I lived here in the Congress House. Actually, you know what? I lived in the Congress House when I moved here in 1991, and they had cable there, and I was watching Comedy Central one afternoon, like 91, 92, and I saw your, I can't find it anywhere now, but I saw your SNL. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm one of the, there's three people that were banned from Saturday Night Live. It was me and Captain Beefheart and
Elvis?
Tom Petty? Trumpet.
Wynton Marsalis?
No.
Miles Davis?
Miles Davis, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He took, yeah.
So what happened? Because you ran out in the
audience.
Yeah,
I ran out. It freaked the camera guys out. It freaked the camera guys out. And they were like, cameras are going around and around. Where do you go? Yeah. You know, and it came. But it was cool. It was a good show. And in retrospect, I did Don't Bug Me, Baby, which was a great rocker. And I did it. But I wish I'd done Buena, because I still play Buena, and it's a really good song. But it was a good show.
I remember seeing Buena on MTV.
Yeah, that was my first video.
Yeah,
we shot that in that video it was controversial because I got arrested in front of Buckingham Palace.
Oh yeah,
we were shooting and I marched. I went in front of the Royal Guardsmen. You know, they're changing to the guards, and I was singing, lip syncing, and. Man, all of a sudden, I felt myself being lifted up off the ground.
Yeah,
you know, and all of a sudden, I was hanging in the air, and I was running, and there was a horse beside me, and I was being, you know, somebody had my neck.
Wow.
Yeah, and the guy was carrying me by the neck, and he said, "You're under arrest." I'm shooting a video, you know, and he says, they sent me down. He says, "You insulted the Queen, and the Prince of Wales, and all this stuff," and I'm going. And I'm thinking, God, they're going to deport me, man, you know? It's like, also, I'm getting arrested in front of Buckingham Palace. I'm just going, God, I've been 3 days in England. I'm already, you know, getting thrown out. But the director came over and apologized and said we were shooting a video. But the sad thing is the camera crew freaked out and stopped shooting when they saw it going down.
Right.
Had they kept shooting, it would have been really...
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been a cool video.
Yeah.
So it's weird. I was just reading this book called I Want My MTV. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-mm.
It's this book that's kind of... It's fantastic. It's one of those books where they have just like a paragraph from like tons of artists, people, executives at MTV, record executives, video directors, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that you were a guy that they wanted to be like the like an MTV artist, like right, an right. artist that you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You
yeah.
did the Christmas song and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is intense, man.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, I just sort of like, you know, okay. It was fun, you know, and I hosted a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Where and it's like, boom, you can host in 30 minutes and be done, you know. I was like, okay. But it was fun. I had a good time doing it. And, you know, I still hear them on satellite radio, you know, Martha Quinn and those guys. And hey, you know, it was good. It's funny. MTV's not the same as it was then or Fresh, you know.
No. Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. I've been in Mexico for 9 years, right?
Yeah.
And they still have MTV shows like MTV in Mexico where it's just bands playing. And you get to see bands from Argentina and all the bands from Mexico. And they still have that vibe down there, which they don't have here. There's music still, you know. Rock and roll is still new to people down there, you know, and they're still, you know, they're not cynical with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And you're getting, it's like really happening. That's one of the reasons I moved to Mexico, because they're still like, man, okay, let's go do it, you know?
Yeah.
And they're still having these cool festivals, and it's a different vibe, but it's really cool. I mean, it's rock and roll. There's great bands. I listen to bands from Argentina and Los Babasónicos and the Fabulous Cadillacs And there's always great bands, rock bands in Mexico. So it's that's what keeps me. And I sit and I don't get what goes on here in the States. So I just get exposed to what's going down there. So I see a little bit what goes on up here, but it's pretty good for me to, you know, down there be there, because I see a different, you know, something different. The way she lied to me,
I did not know. The original MTV poster boy, the extremely talented Joe King Carrasco. What a great dude. Pick up his album, Chileando. That's why he was here back last year. We were talking about that album and his life in Mexico and basically his whole career. Great, great episode, episode 414, with the great Joe King Carrasco. All right, let's go back a few more episodes to episode 408 with the amazing Mike Flanagan. He put out a record last year called The Drifter, which was a fantastic album. And he did each song with a different collaborator. He had people like Gary Clark Jr., Jimmy Vaughn, Cat Edmondson, Stephen Barber, Alejandro Escovedo, Dominique Davalos, Clem Burke, and so many more. And he collaborated on the title track, The Drifter, with the great Billy Gibbons. So here's the story of how Billy Gibbons ended up singing on The Drifter.
Folks, this is about a poor boy. Just a simple old country boy. Who had lost everything in the world he possessed. So he had to sell himself to the devil to get out of this awful mess. So he started riding a black stallion with blood-red eyes, flames flying from his nostrils, and called himself the Drifter. The Drifter.
But there was a song on there called The Drifter, Gate Mouth Brown song, and he sings it, and it's so spooky. Like, when he starts
spookier
that...
Spookier than Gibbons?
Well, I would say...
I didn't hear the original.
The original is, yeah, I mean, it's so spooky. I thought the only person that could honestly pull it off was Gibbons.
Yeah.
So, because when he starts that spoken word intro, this is a story about a poor boy, just a simple old country boy. When I heard Gate Mouth Brown do it, it made an impression, and that album kind of started me on my little journey to where I am now, in a way. But I had forgotten about that album forever, decades. I hadn't heard that record. It's such an obscure record. You don't hear it. Right. You don't have friends that say, "Hey, you know, making music."
Yeah,
like nobody has ever said that to me ever in my life.
Do you know where you can find it now? Is it findable?
It was funny. I was in Denton a few weeks ago visiting my brother, and we went to a nice record, you know, a cool independent record store. And I asked him, just because I was curious, do you have, you know, making music?
Yeah.
And the guy knew the record, and he said, that's a really impossible record to find.
Oh.
And so I don't think it's that available. But I hadn't thought about that record in decades. You know, I hadn't heard it, hadn't come to my mind. And when I originally was going to record a song with Jimmy Vaughn and Billy Gibbons together, the song that me and Jimmy ended up doing on the record. Okay. Well, Gibbons couldn't make it to the studio that night. at the last minute. Gibbons couldn't come. So I ended up writing another song for Gibbons. But right after I had written that song, for whatever reason, the Drifter popped into my head. And I thought, I got to do the Drifter with Gibbons.
Well, it's like it's almost like it was meant to.
I was like,
meant
Gibbons.
That's a.
And so I called Gibbons and I said, "Have you ever heard of this song, The Drifter?" And he had said no. And I sent it to him, and he loved it. And of course, when you hear him on the record, I mean, it was just meant to be. Yeah. I mean, that was meant to be. And that song, I didn't just pick that because it was from my childhood and this would be cool for Gibbons to do.
Right.
I mean, I picked that song because it expressed, when you listen to those lyrics, that's where I was at my life in that time.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
You have to listen to the song to know. Now, it's not like I'm riding a big black stallion with, but I did have that 74 Charger, which I always.
It makes me think like that. That's like your that's like trigger for you.
Right. Right. And I was driving that car. I mean, a lot of stuff was happening that time.
I did it again. Oh.
And a lot of stuff was happening and I couldn't. Oh, wait.
There you go.
That
you
song
just.
Come
do a song in my studio, man. It's,
yeah.
It's pro.
I know.
Go ahead.
But that song said everything I wanted to say.
Right.
Better than I could ever say it. So I had to put it on the record.
Right.
And it really. Of course, that became the title track.
Right.
Because it describes. A way of being, you know.
Yeah.
And it described the album in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Kind of where I ended up, where I started, where I ended up through the journey.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that was the story of the Drifter.
Drifter was his name.
Mike Flanagan talking about his great album, The Drifter, and this title track from that album, The Drifter, as sung by Billy Gibbons. Man, that was a great record release last September. I went to the release show at the Paramount Theater. He had Charlie Sexton in the band. He had Clem Burke sneaking in on drums every once in a while, J.J. Johnson on drums. The Reverend Billy Gibbons came out and played. It was just all kinds of. Cat Edmondson was there. Dominique Davalos came out and played. It was unbelievable. It was a great time. You could tell that the whole community came together to celebrate The Drifter, an album worth checking out by the great Mike Flanagan, all right? Next up, I talked to comedian and comedy writer Chip Pope, a friend of mine from California. He writes for the show, The George Lopez Show, that's on TV Land right now. He's a great writer and a really funny, funny guy. He came over. We had a great conversation. We talked about his writing career, writing for Ellen, writing for Rosie, writing for the new Beavis and Butthead, and a lot more. Here's Chip Pope from episode 417. Yeah, I'll have to see that. I know that you wrote on the Beavis and Butthead. What do you call it?
The redo, I guess, or there were some episodes
reprise.
In 2012 that were on MTV.
Yeah, when I told my Uncle Jack I was talking to you today, he said, "Fuck, dude, tell him I love him."
What?
He's like the world's biggest Beavis and Butthead fan.
It's
and
when so it, crazy. When, well, you I watched said, all the new
I was,
ones and everything?
He was like, he's like, what are you up to today? I was like, oh, I'm doing a podcast with this guy, Chip Pope. And he said, who's that? I was like, oh, you probably know him because he wrote on the redo of Beavis and Butthead. And he was like, oh, fuck, dude, tell him I love him.
That's awesome.
So I said, all right.
Oh, man.
So hey from Uncle Jack.
Well, hey, Uncle Jack.
And and you wrote on Ellen and then the Rosie Show?
Ellen. Oh, God. The Rosie Show. I've worked for all the lesbians. I really have. Ellen, Rosie, I don't know how this happened. Wanda Sykes, who's like the best. And but that's it though. I think I'm out, you know. Unless Rachel Maddow does like a talk show or something. I think I'm
isn't what she does
through with
show?
All the lesbians.
Oh no, just a
well,
news
if she did
talk
like
show.
If she did like an entertainment show. I don't know.
How do you write for a talk show?
Chip? Oh boy. I don't know. Maybe you could give me some pointers.
I don't know.
Because the first one I wrote on, I got fired. And then the second one I wrote on got canceled. So I'm not really sure how you do it. It's a bit of a slog. I don't know how people you know, there'll be some people where you go, like, you look and, you know, they've been, like, the head writer of Conan for, like, 15 years or something, and just like, oh, wow, they must just be tired looking and old and gray, and because it's really a slog. It's like feeding a beast, you know, because you have to every day. It's like, you know, and you watch, and the problem is with some of those shows, it's like you watch it and it looks like nobody did anything and they just are having the show and it's not very good.
Well,
right. But, you know, it takes the same 12 hours a day to make a bad show as it does to make a good show, you know, and so you're just there doing that. So I don't know. I mean, like the Rosie, it's interesting because like the Ellen show, like I have a lot of interesting stories about it, but I can't tell any of them.
Sure.
Because, you sign a non-disclosure form, right. Which, you know, that right there should indicate something that is, maybe that's not the best job in the world. But, I mean, it's everybody's like, that's worked there has like Ellen stories, but, you know, I guess, yeah, gotta wait until certain key parties aren't with us anymore or something.
Right.
But, with the Rosie show though, Rosie O'Donnell is like, she's just exactly what you see. So it's not that it's difficult to do. It's just, I mean, she's obstinate or whatever, but you wouldn't expect anything less, you know?
Right.
Like most people are, there's a lot of people that seem like they're really nice. And then behind the scenes, they're not so nice. But then when you see people that are just exactly what you'd think, like you wouldn't expect to work with Rosie O'Donnell and just think, well, she must be a kitty cat to work with. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're getting. So, in that way, it's great because you always would know where you stood, you know, and it was in like a pile of shit. but it was also like fun. It was like one of the more interesting experiences I had because it was in Chicago. And so I lived in Chicago for like 4 months during the winter. Oh, and we're all out there at the Oprah studios and there's just snow and everything. And, you know, I always likened it to like The Shining, you know, I just like to think of it like
getting
that.
Locked in the Overlook.
You're just out there. Yeah. You're just out there in the hotel and there's this some crazy maniac running around. You're like enabling her, you know?
So I read on your Twitter that you wrote some for the new Natasha Leggero. This is going to come out after it airs, but
The new Comedy Central. Oh, yeah. There's a show this weekend, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a hell of a lot of fun. She's my favorite. Like, I've known Natasha for a long time, and she's, you know, just getting some steam going. I mean, she's on, like, on Comedy Central, like, all the time. She might as well be, like, the lady of Comedy Central, because she has her own show, that Another Period, that's on there. Have you heard of that show? It's really funny. It takes place in like 1903. It's kind of like if you put the Kardashians into Downton Abbey, basically.
Oh, okay.
And so it's just these socialites. It's basically the first two women that really wanted to get famous by doing nothing, you know, just being socialites. It's very funny. I mean, they've had like Jack Black and Ben Stiller. I mean, they've had like some really serious guest stars in there too. And then, you know, and then it's like her on the roast, you know.
Yeah, I saw her on the roast.
Written some roast jokes for her for
the
for the Justin Bieber one and then the one from the year before. And then we did this stuff. And Howard's in the hip-hop video that's going to be in her special.
Oh, really?
If it's still in there, you never know. I don't know. I don't know what, like, makes the cut and everything.
Right.
But, yeah, and some sketches and stuff like that. It was really fun. We filmed it up in San Francisco at Bimbo's. Have you ever heard of that place?
Uh-uh.
It's really just this amazing old-time supper club that's been around since the 40s.
They have music and stuff there?
Yeah, they have music. Just the stage. It's amazing because it's just kind of like in that same condition, vintage condition that it was in the 40s. So it was like the perfect place for her special because she's like really elegant and everything. And then we did a thing where we showed I really felt bad afterwards because it was my idea, but I was like, why don't we just go out to Downey or somewhere and show a test group of, you know, these kind of like mutants that watch focus group mutants and just show them the stand-up, you know, that you did last week. And so we're just watching them through one-way mirror. A few of them are laughing. It's just like 10 random people. You know, a few of them are laughing. A few are just like, okay, whatever. Because it's, you know, 3 in the afternoon and they're watching stand-up. So it's like, you know, they're not drunk or on a show, and it's not going to be the same thing. And Natasha just has her hand over her face the whole time. I'm just like, I'm so sorry for this idea. And then it's and then she goes in and just surprises them. You know, they start talking about what they think about her and everything, and then she just walks in on them. You know, and so it was weird. One group reacted like, oh yeah, she's just gonna walk in on us. For some reason it's like they all thought that. And then another group was like really surprised, you know. But
it's weird.
It was so funny too, and like all that, and just the responses were so different. It's so different. I don't know. I just always empathize with females in comedy because it's just such a hard racket. Because it's just like everyone in the focus group, the females were all concentrating on what she was. They were all talking about what she was wearing, or, you know, I mean, mainly what she was wearing. Like this one girl was just like, "Why did you wear that dress? It looked like you were crashing a prom, you know, and stuff." And Natasha's like, "What should I wear?" And she's like, "You should just wear jeans and like a tank top and like, you know, you're going to the club, you know." And then all the guy, and you know, and the focus group person was like, "Did you find what she was wearing distracting?" And like almost all the women were like yes, and the guys were just like, "What? What about what she was talking about?" You know, it was really interesting to see.
I don't know if you guys saw that Natasha Leggero special, but it was very, very funny. I suggest you go back and check it out. Okay, Chip Pope, hilarious guy from episode 417. Let's go up to episode 468, where I talked to Lincoln Durham right after he released his album, Lincoln Durham's Revelations of a Mind Unraveling. We had a lot of talks about a mind unraveling, but in this part of the conversation, we were talking about living inside your head, even when you're a little kid. From 468, this is my conversation with Lincoln Durham.
I keep, you know, just pulling it to the right. She keeps it straight, so it's nice.
Because you don't know what you're doing outside of the music making and performing?
No.
And stuff.
No.
That was very confident,
not,
no.
Oh, yeah, no.
No.
I'm not good at life at all whatsoever. As long as I'm in my head and I'm seeing all the amazing, you know, fake dream world that I live in, then I'm fine. But if I have to exist outside, I'm screwed. And she's very good at taking my hand.
Yeah. Does she ever get frustrated with you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I can't. I don't live. You know. I the main thing I think she gets frustrated is having to repeat herself because I ask questions and I don't listen to the answer.
Right.
I'm real bad about that. But I grow through life. I live my life, you know, like a half inch, you know, inside my eyes. So I'm seeing everything that's going on, but I'm just not.
You're almost spectating.
Quite out there.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm not in the world. I'm. It's like if I was a little guy controlling myself in my head, and I'm looking through the whole thing through a windshield. You
know, did you have a tough time when you were a kid before you had this sort of like, oh, I'm this kind of person,
oh,
so
yeah,
I can throw myself into this life and I'm not such a fucking outcast?
Yeah, for sure.
Were you what?
Super introverted. You know, I was the kid that had no, you know, I was no, I was nothing. You know, I was no, was it, you know, my music is very gothy. I've always been very, you know, just kind of a pessimistic, dark, person, not scary dark, but just, you know, just dark, you know, depressive, just a lot of mental stuff going on. But I wasn't a kid, you know, like, no, I've been off and on, yeah. But I wasn't even like, so I was a very kind of gothy kid, but I wasn't even that goth kid, you know, in school. I was just that, I always joke, I show people, this is true, in my yearbook, you know, everybody, it's so and so. And then here's the list of things that they did, you know. Even the you know, jerk kid, you know, here's, you know, the things that he did.
Oh, right, right.
And then it's Lincoln Durham, and there's nothing. It just says my name. There's nothing after it.
No track.
No track.
Underwater macrame or whatever.
No president of it. Not even Biggest Loser. It's just nothing.
You weren't even like the leader of the dipshits.
No, I wasn't even, you know, like the kid that got picked on. I was just nothing, you know? So I just didn't know what to, you know, Yeah, I didn't know what I was for a long time, and it wasn't until I started writing that I started to realize what I was. And a lot of people kind of become what they are. I didn't become what I am till.
Did you escape into like music and TV and movies and books? And
for me, it was always I wasn't the kid that I didn't have a hard time making friends, but I just didn't want friends. I liked playing by myself. I just make up these.
Says the man who grew up and started a one man band.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's just once you're on a trajectory, you kind of keep rolling. Yeah. I'm one of those. I'm a firm believer that I heard an interview. I'm not to get off track, but I'm an NPR junkie, and I heard an interview, and they were. I don't know who it was, like a Terry Gross interview with someone. I have no idea who it was, but I'd written maybe a movie or something. But anyway, long story short, they had to write it as what they were as an old person. And I think the question was, was it difficult to write yourself as, as like an 80-year-old when you're say, 30 or 40. And his response was no, because I think you're pretty much, I think when I'm 80, I'm going to be the same person. And I do believe that. I think, it's, you get older, you get wiser, but you're kind of just the same person.
Wasn't it Tom Waits? Because she asked Tom Waits that kind of question. Like, were you always some weird old man? And he was like, yes.
Yeah. Well, no, it wasn't Tom, because I'm a glorious fan of Tom Waits, too. And I would have remembered if it was Tom Waits. But yeah, that's a good example. It's just like, you kind of, as you get to a certain age, I think you start realizing, what are you going to be like when you're old? I'm going to be like this, just a little more, rotting away.
Yeah.
So, but the trajectory was the same. I was a loner. I enjoyed that. I just kind of made these worlds, in my head, and I enjoyed it. And that unfortunately for people like Alyssa is the way I still live. I still live in a very internal world, of all kinds of cool stuff, but
shut up now and listen to him. Can't you hear him? You're making me be my head against the wall.
The amazing Lincoln Durham. His album, Revelations of a Mind Unraveling, is out. Pick it up. He was on tour earlier this year with Reverend Horton Heat. In fact, when we did that, he was about to go out on tour. He's such a great guy. Go back and check out episode 468. A beautiful guy with a beautiful story and just an amazing songwriter and musician. All right? All right, let's go up to episode 407, where I talk to the amazing director Penelope Spheeris and her daughter, Anna. You might know Penelope because she directed the movie Wayne's World. She directed Black Sheep. But in the 80s and 90s, she directed a documentary series called Decline of Western Civilization. Part one was the punk years. Part two was the metal years. Part three was like the kids that lived on the streets in like the 90s. But the late 80s one, the middle one, the metal years, is the most popular. It tackled the Sunset Strip. She talked to people like Ozzy Osbourne. She talked to people like Paul Stanley. She talked to people like Alice Cooper in this movie. And it's famous because a lot of these guys were very self-indulgent. They were kind of all kind of dumb and kind of like weird, like, I'm going to be the hugest star in the world. There were bands like Odin that you never heard of again and all kinds of stuff. But there was one scene that's always kind of freaked me out since I first started seeing this movie in the early 90s. And that's that when Paul Stanley's being interviewed, there's a camera above him and he's laying in a bed with three women. And I always thought she must have come to his house to interview him and he was laying there with three women. So anyway, I got to ask Penelope Spheeris on behalf of myself and my friends that I used to watch this movie with, why the hell was Paul Stanley with three girls? So here's Penelope and Anna Spheeris talking to me from episode 407. About why Paul Stanley is in bed with three girls during his interview. So what all did you do to the movies? Like, you cleaned them up, or?
Well, yeah, we did 2K restoration on the original negatives, and that was mostly a part I sat in on because I'm real particular about the timing and the look of it all. And then Anna is the one that she was there for a lot of the timing and everything, but also she's the one that worked on the extras because I honestly couldn't handle it.
Right.
Well, the extras are great, and it actually answered one of my questions about Decline 2. But can I, on behalf of my other musician friends, I'm a musician as well, that came up watching that movie. The scene.
Either got to be the orange juice or the vodka.
No. That I do have a question about that, but I think that one's pretty self-explanatory. What I want to talk about is Paul Stanley, because when you first see that movie, before you're really in the business, you're like, wow, that guy wakes up with three girls in a bed. And that's how he conducts an interview. But then as you get older and you start figuring out who you are as a person and you yourself as are an artist and you do interviews, you're like, whose idea was that? I saw in the extras that obviously they were there when you showed up, right? The ladies?
Oh, when I showed up?
Yeah.
No, what happened was when Paul showed up, we had the camera all set up and I had the girls already there.
Oh, okay.
And then he took me aside. I remember he took me into this bedroom and said, we sat on the bed and he goes, Penelope, those girls are not good looking enough that you have here. Yeah. So I said, well, I don't have any more girls, you know? And he goes, hold on a minute. And he calls the Playboy Mansion. So we had to wait until the girls came down. Yeah.
That is amazing. He's an interesting cat. He's a very quotable guy. He knows how to speak in quotes.
Well, yes, he does. And here's the thing. I'm really glad that Anna put all these, strung all the entire interviews together. Because that's the extras for Decline 2, because it's actually being more fair to Paul. I think I was not fair to Paul when I cut the movie. I think I grabbed little pieces and, you know, he said that he was trying to be funny during the whole thing, but it didn't turn, you know, you weren't laughing with him. You might've been laughing at him in the
exactly.
movie, but if you watch the extras, then you're laughing with him.
Yeah. Yeah, you're
really
in on the
joke. More fair to Paul because he's a good dude and he's really smart and he's really cool and I'm glad that now people can see it right.
That's good. That's good. It was interesting seeing in the extras as well. I got to see some of the panels that you did and it was interesting seeing Nader from London on there. And it's interesting to see that they're still playing and it's good to see that they're still playing and out there doing it. How many
people? Anna's more in touch with those guys actually than me because... what's Nader up to, Anna?
Yeah.
London. he's still got as much energy as he did back then. I don't know how he does that, but he does.
Well, he got clean now, too, so that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, he's still doing London. They play shows, and he and his girlfriend just adopted a dog from me.
Oh, that's awesome.
I did not know that.
Yeah, well, from Pet Orphans through Suzanne, I got him.
I thought you were going to say a kid, and I'm like, oh, you had an extra one?
No, I got an extra dog. I got lots of extra dogs.
So, well, then, Anna, let me ask you, what happened to Odin?
Oh, my gosh. I talked to the brothers, Duncan brothers. I talked to Sean a bit.
Is that the drummer and guitar player?
Something? Yeah, so there's this jam night on Wednesdays in Hollywood at Lucky Strike. They're doing a big one next week with Gene Simmons and Johnny Depp. But anyway, so Sean goes to that a lot, so I see him. And the first night that Sean and Jeff were going to be, and the other brother, actually, the twin brother, Jeff's twin brother, were going to be, it's a jam night where they like rotate like 40 different musicians doing covers. And when they announced that Jeff and Sean were there, the guy, of course, has to, you know, say, and they're from Odin, Odin, Odin.
Oh, God.
That's one of the weirdest parts of the movie because it's just that Ghazari guy saying it. And then he gets that girl. Penelope... I got to tell you something. There's a level of humanity that you bring out in each of the movies that I didn't really get until watching it now in my 40s. After seeing it when I was a kid and kind of laughing, because it was especially the second one was something that you watched with your friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone got together and got stoned and like, oh, let's watch Western Civilization. All right. And you're laughing at everyone, but there is a. You really, I don't. There's so you captured their humanity so well, and it you have a really great heart.
Well, thank you. That is the ultimate compliment, and I have to say, I got it from Gypsy, my mother.
Oh, that's
and yeah, I swear to God, like my mom, everybody loved her, and through my life, I've always thought, well, if I could just be loved as much as my mother was, I would feel like I. I'm a success. So to hear that compliment is so fine. Thank you so much, Johnny.
Well, you're welcome. It really sort of climaxes in the third one because that one's just so. All right, the amazing Penelope Spheeris. You know what's interesting is that she works with her daughter, and they work very closely. That's their job, is they work together, so they spend all this time together. So I guess. It was passed on to another generation because Anna probably feels the same way about Penelope as Penelope felt about her mom. All right, that conversation meant a lot to me. I'm a huge fan of Penelope and I'm a huge fan of her work since the short films of Saturday Night Live that she did with Albert Brooks, Wayne's World, the Decline of Western Civilization series, everything. I bought that Decline of Western Civilization series the day it came out, way before I interviewed her. So it was very exciting to get to talk to her. So I'd like to thank my friend Amy Edwards and the Austin Film Society for setting that up for me. All right. Next up, I talked to Brandon Temple, an amazing drummer and musician. Our conversation was one of my all-time favorites. All right. It's almost 2 hours long. It was great. I got a lot of lessons in different musical histories, which the guy's like an encyclopedia. He's so sweet. He's so cool, and he's such an amazing musician. I know that he's playing on Wednesday nights in Austin here, the One-to-One Bar with Eric Johnson, the great guitarist. So check it out. I asked Brandon Temple what was happening with jazz and what happened to jazz. Why did it become marginalized? And his answer was long, but it's incredibly informative, and he's like a history teacher. He should teach a history of jazz class. That's what I think. I want to thank my friend Amanda Martin for talking Brandon into doing this because I know he's a shy guy, didn't really feel too comfortable about doing it, but when he really found out what it was and he came and did it, we had such a great time, and I feel like we're a lot closer. So here's my amazing conversation from episode 472 with Brandon Temple.
No,
yeah, so. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because jazz has been so strangely like marginalized, and it's such like a niche thing in America. And it seems like in Europe, it still has more vitality. Does that make sense? I don't mean it as a musical form. I just mean the way that people consume it, or even like find it or get into it. It's
That's a tough one, man, because. You're right in a lot of ways because most of, like one of the artists that I perform with on a regular basis, her name is Liz Wright, and she's been around in the industry maybe like 12, 13 years. And she's, major deal, Verve Records to Concord Records, which is, it's like a lower company to, maybe Sony or somebody like that. I can't remember who owns Concord. I'm sorry. But, she's virtually unknown here.
Right.
And although she's not a traditional jazz, authentic jazz, straight-ahead jazz artist, most of our gigs are jazz festival, jazz-oriented gigs.
Right.
And for the Europeans to embrace her as well as many other artists. Yeah, most of the lives of these musicians, their careers are realized presently in Europe.
Yeah.
So the audiences are there. The infrastructure is there.
Right.
The promoters, the clubs, the,
right.
the festivals, the fans. Like everything is really suited more for them, for their entertainment, for their enjoyment. And even a lot of, let's say, jazz artists are sort of known, like almost say like, I won't put on the same level, but like a pop artist, maybe not like a Katy Perry or something like that, but like there's a gentleman by the name of Gregory Porter, who's a vocalist, really, really stellar, younger male vocalist, like in his early 40s, mid 40s, who German market, you know, completely embraced him. And just, you know, you could hear this cat on ads, see his music, hear his music on ads, and it'd be filtered behind the Weather Channel in Germany. Right. You know what I mean? It's like, so yeah, there's an avenue there for those types of artists to express themselves. Yeah. You know, and work.
Yeah. What do you think happened in America with what?
Oh, you know, man, that's a whole
too much stuff.
Yeah,
too much information coming at us.
I'd say what really happened in America with jazz, and this is just my personal opinion, my own humble opinion. It has nothing to do with fact, you know. But I feel like on one level, the invention of bebop was a demise of swing music becoming the most popular music, because at that time, all the bands like the Duke Ellingtons, the Count Basies, the Benny Goodmans, the, you know, all these groups like this, right, that were widely spread, and for every three or four of those bands, there were about 50 other working bands very similar.
Right.
Large groups, large ensembles. Of course, you had the World War II, where a lot of people got sent off, got deployed, you know.
Right.
And once the war was over and people came back to work, well, the infrastructure was different, where there all the money had been distributed for wartime.
Right.
So band leaders were sort of forced to have smaller bands. So there were more out-of-work musicians.
Huh.
This is what happened with a lot of these swing guys. And pretty much that's all
there was. Because
bands were huge. Yeah, you're talking, you know, 17 to 25 piece bands, you know, one nighters, and a bus, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so that there was that infrastructure with union and union dues and hotels. Everybody was accustomed to that lifestyle in America. People that went to go see music, you know, you had supper clubs, you had, you know, these, it was a vibe, the whole thing. Yeah. So then once, let's say, you know, musicians like Max Roach and Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and these types of people started creating music that was centered more around the idea of a smaller group.
Right.
You know, then it changed the face of the sound. It changed how, you know, people heard the music. One of the most unknown artists worldwide, of course, in the jazz world, we know him, but one of the biggest catalysts for this change was a drummer. You know, two different drummers. There's Kenny Clark and there's Max Roach.
I know Max Roach, but I don't know Kenny Clark.
And so Kenny Clark was around the same time as Max Roach. Okay. And he was lesser known because he was a musician that he wasn't as band leader savvy as a Max Roach. He was a supporter.
Right.
But how he supported the musicians was in a new language that had to, basically what it did was it gave the drummer more responsibility as opposed to just going.
Right.
Like a chank rhythm guitar that just played ting, 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 you know, change, you know.
Yeah.
Changing, chords every two beats, you know.
Right.
Where that function was no longer necessary, you wanted more identity based on the soloist.
Right.
So the soloist became the star. And now at this point, the language became more special in terms of if you had a side or a record or like a Duke Ellington or a Count Basie record where it was a little more through composed. So most of these tunes were show tunes.
Right.
So the majority of the record, which could have been like 2 minutes long, it was the lyric from the show tune.
Right.
Played in an instrumental fashion.
Right.
So now you have a musician like a Charlie Parker who might take those show tunes,
right,
but now gives you the first verse of it, but then takes the ideas and expounds on them.
Right.
So you can't sing along with that.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it changes the listener's experience.
Come on, don't turn back.
One of my favorite conversations that I've had on this show, the amazing drummer Brandon Temple, episode 472. There is a lot more to that story, and it goes on. The guy is a historian. He is a music historian. He's amazing. Such a sweet guy. Loved talking to him. Go back, listen to episode 472. It's almost 2 hours long. It's unbelievable. All right, let's go up to episode 405, where I talk to somebody who I've actually become friends with through the podcast. This is Emily Wolf, and we were talking about her getting sober, and there was some very heavy stuff going on. But before we get into this, let me tell you, I was asked to be in a documentary about her that's airing on uprocks.com this month. I'll post something about it on the Facebook page. I actually got to see an advanced screening of it, and it's really moving. It's really great, and I'm very proud to get to be in it. I'm flattered that they asked me to be in it, and I'm a big fan of Emily's. It's probably why they asked me to be in it. We had a great conversation for episode 405 down at Word Studios, my friend Juan Alcina, who I'm very excited to see tonight at episode 500. I'm very excited about that. Anyway, great conversation with Emily Wolf, and she's gotten sober. She hit a bottom, man. She hit some places, got physically sick, had to have brain surgery. Yeah, let's go to episode 405, where we talk to my friend, the amazing Emily Wolf. How are you doing now? You've gone through some shit.
Oh yeah, I'm doing well. I'm the happiest I've ever been, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sober what, now.
And, yeah. What was going on? What were you doing that you had to get sober? Drinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was drinking every single day. It was really difficult. It was one of those things where it's like you just like fall into something. And then it just becomes this monster, and you don't know how in denial you are about it until something huge happens. Like, I had to, you know, go to the hospital several times because of it, and I don't know. It was difficult.
Because it was making you physically ill.
Yeah. I mean, it was so bad. And I never thought that I could become that bad, you know. But it was to a point where I had to, like, relearn how to play sober, you know, and you know, how to enjoy playing just as myself again. It was pretty intense. Yeah, it was making me physically ill. I had brain surgery from it. I had seizures and this brain bleed, and it was just this whole mess.
Was this over the last couple of years since I saw you last?
Yeah, it was last July. So I've been doing a lot of self-searching and changing. So,
I bet.
Yeah, it's intense.
So it affected your brain and you were having seizures.
Yeah.
How much, I mean, like, how long did you drink like that every day? If you don't mind my, do you mind talking
about
this?
Okay, yeah, good. We should talk about it. Let's see, probably a solid year. I got into the whole, like, okay, I'm going to hair of the dog because I can't stand a hangover. And so then it just spiraled into this huge thing, and I was drinking every day, all day, you know. And I just, like, had to find a way out. And luckily, though, it's weird because I feel like really big things in your life that, you know, like being in the hospital for 2 weeks with a blood clot in my brain, like, that was my reset button. You know, it got so bad that I had to, something that drastic had to happen for me to pull myself out of it. So, yeah.
So it wasn't like you decided to go into recovery or something. It's like,
oh no, I had
your
to.
Body was, decided for you.
Yeah, it was definitely life or death. yeah, I was like, I cannot do this. I can't do this to my body and, you know, to the people around me. And it was intense.
When you were drinking, were you difficult? Were you blacking out or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not on stage or anything, but afterward, it would get to the point where...
So it was one of those things where there was some control in
it. There...
Like, you weren't out of control wasted on stage.
Oh, no, no, no.
You knew better than to do that.
Yeah, totally. Okay. I mean...
But then afterwards, no holds barred.
No. Yeah, for sure. That's what it was. I mean, I would have a couple drinks before I went on stage and maybe one during, but I never let it get in the way of the way the music sounded. I hope I didn't. I don't think I did. But, you know, off stage, it was a different story. It was pretty intense.
What have you found, like, in your recovery afterwards? Where did your alcoholism stem from? Insecurities?
A lot of things. I feel like it kind of stemmed from... Let's see. That's a good question. Let me see if I can put it into words.
Okay. You can use this dry erase board to draw a picture of it, a diagram if you wish, a pie chart.
Yeah, I might. I might need to. I felt kind of out of control of my business. I'm an independent musician, and I play with a lot of, you know, I play with people. A band that is no longer my band. They've since moved on to different things. Because I don't know, I really enjoy writing alone, and I feel like, you know, my songs are just like so, it's really difficult for me to express myself in any other way. And so, I would write these songs and bring them to my band and be like, hey, guys, like, you know, if you feel like it, here's some, you could, you know, add parts to this. And it kind of felt like I was giving my songs away, and I had a lot of anxiety over that, just other people adding stuff to it that I didn't really feel like they understood the lyrics and, like, the emotion that I wanted out of my lyrics. And it just felt like I was giving away my house or my car or, like, my pets, you know, like, having other people write with me. I don't know if that sounds weird, but...
No, I understand what that means.
Okay. So that was one thing, and then I had, you know, really intense anxiety, just general anxiety.
From episode 405, that was one of my favorites, Emily Wolf, a person who I've become friends with through the podcast. Also, may I point something out? At the very last thing that she says is general anxiety. And doesn't that sound like someone you might have served under when you were in Vietnam?
Yeah, sir, back in Nam, I was under general anxiety.
All right, Emily Wolf, go back and check that out. Check out her music, too. Amazing, amazing artist. All right, last but not least, one of my favorite conversations I had over the last 100 episodes was one I had during South by Southwest for episode 477 when I got to talk to the legendary Bruce Sudano. You might know Bruce Sudano is a great, great songwriter. He was married to Donna Summer, and he wrote songs like Heaven Knows and also Bad Girls, but he's also a solo artist. And he just put out a new album called The Burbank Sessions, unbelievable record. Fantastic artist, and just what a great conversation we got to have. We talked about his album, but also, and his career. But during this part, we talked about his transition in songwriting into the 80s and kind of like trying to stay vital in music. It was a great conversation with the legendary Bruce Sudano. There's like a I'm 47, and I've done this since I was 13, like you did since you were a kid, and you grow up doing this, and you wonder, you see guys either fall by the wayside, feel irrelevant. Some people just keep keep making music from the heart, and that's what I get from you. It's like,
you're
just making your music, and you're in a different phase, but it's so honest and so real that there's nothing ridiculous about
what you're doing. Exactly. You know, I mean, it's a surprise to me too. Yeah, I call it getting off the train. You know, I mean, I've seen a lot of people just get off the train.
And you don't blame them.
No.
After a while, this is like being in a dryer.
I mean, the thing is, you have to feel creative. You have to be inspired.
Yeah.
And so, you know, life is its own journey, and, you know, things happen. And when you're an artist, you respond to things that happen. And so in doing that, it's I remain vital to myself.
Yeah.
And I remain inspired to myself. So it's not like I feel like I'm forcing myself, or I feel like I continue to be inspired. And I feel like I'm a new artist at this point in my life. You know, it's like, because I'm on a different road, doing a different thing than I've ever done before. Because I've done a lot of things, but I've never been the solo artist going out there and just being me. You know, so
even like in the early 80s when you did it?
No, because in the early 80s, what happened was I was in Brooklyn Dreams up until 1980.
Right.
Then I recorded a solo record as me. And at the same year I got married, my wife got pregnant. And it was kind of like a false start, because I immediately shut down the solo Bruce Sedano, because there was no way I could maintain my family, my relationship, my wife having her career, and me trying to be a solo guy at the same time. So I just cut, I continued writing and producing and doing stuff like that. But this guy never got to, you know, be the guy that I am now, you know. Yeah. So
that's interesting. And, when you talk about that time, there's when I guess the end of Brooklyn Dreams, the music shift was going against so much. You know what I mean? Like the disco sucks phase started swinging that way.
Yeah.
And then you wrote a great song for Dolly Parton that ended up on the top of the country charts.
Yeah.
Genius, by the way. I know it probably wasn't planned, but genius.
Definitely wasn't planned. Yeah. It's all an accident. You know, I mean, most things are accidental. You know, the thing is, you do what you do. You stay in the game and you keep walking down the road and you see what happens, you know. So... first and foremost, Brooklyn Dreams was never meant to be a disco band. You know, we were an R&B
driven. I was listening to some of the songs, like some deep funk.
And so we got, because of what was going on in the moment.
Of course.
You know, so the first Brooklyn Dreams record, I was always trying to do hybrids of things. So, I grew up as a kid who was inspired by the Brill Building songwriters.
Yeah.
My main band was early Rolling Stones. I mean, so like when I put bands together, I mean, that's kind of the elements that was driving me. And so Brooklyn Dreams just came into a time when disco was exploding, and our record deal got sold to Casablanca Records, and the first thing that they said to us is, you guys got to do this.
Right.
You know, and, but, you know, I mean, I was always trying to do hybrid. So, like, there's a song on the first, Brooklyn Dreams album called Street Dance, you know. So it was an element of funk, an element of rock, and an element of R&B. And so I would always try and incorporate it in, I loved R&B music. But lyrically, R&B music always left me a little. It was always, other than Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye and Stevie, it was a little. Always became cliched, So I was always more attracted to, on their lyrical side of a Jackson Brown and all that, and so I was always kind of trying to a hybrid stuff. And subsequently, what happens is when you do that is that. People never know what category to put you in.
Right.
You know, so you're not quite R&B, you're not quite pop, you're not quite this. So it's not necessarily a good thing to do. But
So that's why even what I'm doing now is like, it's like Cindy, my manager, is kind of like encouraging me to streamline it down to even more of just me and Randy, because even in what we do now, there's jazz elements and elements and
well, that's what I like, is that there's a minor seventh and major seventh thing you're not scared to do in that G, C, D world. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I can't help myself.
Of course not.
So
You know the language. Why deny the knowledge?
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. So.
While well-intended loved ones offer up their explanations past the mountains that I'm facing, gotta wait.
It's like talking to like Obi-Wan Kenobi or something. I love Bruce Sedano, man. Get out there and check out the Burbank Sessions. It's fantastic. Also, go to episode 477. Listen to our whole conversation. It's really great. He's a fantastic dude. And Bruce Sedano. All right, guys, that's it. That's it for our clip show, the highlights of the last 100 episodes. I want to thank all my guests that have come and been on the show, all the publicists and people, managers that have helped me get guests on the show, friends that have helped me get guests on the show, all kinds of people. It takes all kinds of people to make this show happen. But most of all, it takes you, the listener, to listen to it. So thank you so much for listening. It's been a really great experience doing this podcast. I cannot tell you. I'm very excited. I'm doing this the day before this podcast comes out, and I'm getting ready to go record episode 500 tonight with AJ Vallejo, Susanna Schofel, Nakia, Kathy Valentine, and Taylor Muse from Quiet Company. That show will be out on Friday. And I want to thank all of you guys for listening. I want to thank all the guests. This has been a great experience. I love it. I look forward to the next 500. What do you think of that? Jesus, that's a lot. Okay. One last bit of business before we go. For the last few years since I started this podcast, I've announced my summer jams as they've come up. 2012, you'll remember, was Carly Rae Jepsen's Call Me Maybe. 2013 was a great jam. It was Get Lucky by Daft Punk. 2014 was In the Street by Spanish Gold. 2015, for some reason I can't remember, I guess it wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't that great of one. This year, I'm gonna announce mine tonight at the live podcast. So, or I guess it was last night. So, my summer jam for the summer of 2016 is "Make Me Like You" by Gwen Stefani. Did I just try and sound like Casey Kasem? Yeah, my summer jam is "Make Me Like You" by Gwen Stefani. I heard it and has that summer feeling. I like the singing. I like the melody. I like the backing vocals. So yeah, I'm into it. Summer 2016, we're here. Episode 499. Look for episode 500 on Friday. My guests will be Susanna Schofel, AJ Vallejo, Kathy Valentine, Taylor Muse from Quiet Company, and the mighty Nakia. All right, thank you so much for listening to this show. I love doing this show. I really do. Next Tuesday for episode 501, I have a special guest. Artist Bree Bagwell will be here. It's going to blow your mind. We have a great conversation. She's a great lady. All right? Thank you so much for listening to How Did I Get Here? Here is my summer jam for 2016, "Make Me Like You" by Gwen Stefani. Let's get down.
I was fine before I met you. I was broken but fine. I was lost and uncertain, but my heart was still mine. I was free before I met you. I was broken but free. All alone in a clear view, but now you are. Hey, wait a minute. No, you can't do this to me. Wait a minute. No, that's not fair. Hey, wait a minute. You're on me like jewelry. I really like it, but I'm so scared.
Why you have to go and make me like you? Yeah, this is a feeling I'm not used to. Why you have to go and make me
God. Thank God that I found you.